For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
The Joseph story. Let's take a read. We want to break it down into just kind of the scenes that make up the story. And the first is just the introductory piece, the birth of Joseph and his early life. And Joseph is introduced to us in a way that's familiar to some of us as we've been reading through Genesis together, where it says Rachel was barren. And if you'll remember, that theme of the barren woman has occurred in three generations now of the patriarchs, first to Abraham, then to Isaac, now to Jacob and his wife. And it always precedes this idea that God does what humanity can't do. And God is passing this promise that he's going to bless the world through the establishing of this blessing to Israel. And that there's nothing that humans can do to earn it. We don't deserve it in any way. It's always the gift of God that he alone can deliver. And so to demonstrate this perspective on grace, this idea that God alone can deliver what he promises, the birth of these three patriarchs in a row emerge out of this improbable birth. Rachel is barren. But then it goes on and says in chapter 30 that God remembered Rachel and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son, saying, God has taken away my reproach, and she named him Joseph. So Joseph, as we're told in the narrative, was loved by Israel more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made for him a technicolor tunic. His brothers saw that Israel loved Joseph more, and so they hated him. So you have the kind of emergence of a little family drama coming on here. The favored son who gets the special robe, and his brothers are like, you know, why does he get the affections of dad? This kind of thing. Then, to compound the family dynamic problem, Joseph has a series of dreams. And it says that Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers, they hated him even more. Three times in this little sequence, it says they hated him, they hated him, they hated him even more. And so Joseph says, please listen to the dream. We were binding sheaves in the field, and my sheaf rose erect, and your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaves. Stupid thing to say as a little brother. His brother said, are you really going to reign over us? And so they hated him even more than they hated him the three other times they said they hated him. Then Joseph had another dream, and he told this to his brothers, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing to me, he said. And Joseph told his dad about this, and his brothers and his father Israel rebuked him, saying, shall I and your mother and your brothers really come down and bow down before you? And his brothers were jealous. But here's the interesting thing. His father kept the saying in mind, because Israel knew that God spoke to him and came to him in dreams, as he did with his father Isaac before him and his father Abraham before him. And it is a part, really, of God revealing himself in the ancient Near Eastern world that in part these things come through unusual visions, dreams, things like that. And the dreams, of course, are not self-authenticating. The reality is either these things come to pass or they don't, and that is the sign of authenticity that these things are true. But they take notice of them. And so Israel, or Jacob, is taking notice of this incredible dream or series of dreams that his son Joseph has. Well, the story goes on. His brothers are not very happy about the preferential treatment of little brother. They surely are offended by the dreams that he's having. And so they plot against him. His brothers saw him coming from a distance as they were out pasturing their flocks in Dothan. And they said to one another, here comes the dreamer. Let's go and kill him, throw him into one of the pits. Yeah, good brother. We'll say that a wild beast devoured him. But Reuben, the voice of reason, said, let's don't take his life, shed no blood. So they took Joseph, they stripped him of his tunic and threw him into the pit. Then they sold Joseph to a Midianite trader, traders who were passing by, and so Joseph was taken to Egypt. They took Joseph's tunic and they dripped goat's blood on it. They gave the tunic to Israel, saying, we found the tunic. And Israel examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. So Jacob mourned for many days. My favorite son is dead and killed by this savage way, by some wild beast ripping his life out from him. Then the narrative shifts to Joseph as he's been sent off to Egypt. And this is really where the focus of the story lies. And I want us to think of it in a couple of ways. First, because there is a historical narrative unfolding. God is telling us, the narrator is telling us, the things that are actually going on in space and time, things that are happening in history, and they're important things. But we will also notice at the end of our study that there is another axis, a vertical axis, namely something between man and God going on. And that is the real important driver in this story, that biblical history is not merely a sequence of actual events that take place in space and time, although clearly that is the case. This is not mythology, this is history. But it's God's history. History is the theater or the stage of God's revelation to humanity. And that reality comes out so clearly in this story that whatever man is up to, God's up to something too. And so we want to be mindful of both of these things. Let's first take a look at what man is up to, the horizontal axis. The first scene in Joseph's life in Egypt is in Potiphar's house. Joseph was taken to Egypt where Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguards, bought him from the Midianites. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became successful, and he was made overseer over Potiphar's house. We're going to see a bit of a pattern there. Joseph was successful. And Joseph, it says, also was a bit of a honk, a handsome man. And Potiphar's wife took notice of him. She said, lie with me. But he refused. My master has entrusted everything to me. He has withheld nothing from me but you. How can I do this great evil and sin against God? Well, woman spurned, bad thing. One day Joseph went into the house to work, and no one was there except for Potiphar's wife, and she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And Joseph fled, leaving his garment in her hand. Then she called to the men of the house, saying, this Hebrew has made sport of us. He came into my room to lie with me, and I screamed. So he fled, leaving his garment here. When Potiphar heard this, he burned in anger, and Joseph was put in jail. Footnote. But the Lord was with Joseph. Okay? So the story goes on. Jail time. The Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him, and in time gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. Joseph was given charge of all the prisoners. See the pattern as it's developing? He sold to Potiphar. He's been made lord of Potiphar's house. The bottom falls out of that sequence. He's sent to jail, but he finds favor among the jailers and becomes the chief in charge of all the prisoners. And so as it turns out, after these things, that the cupbearer and the baker for Pharaoh offended their lord. But he put them in jail. So he put them in jail, the same place Joseph was in prison. And Joseph wasn't put in charge of them. One night, both the cupbearer and the baker had a dream. And just to simplify it, we're going to focus on the cupbearer. Joseph interpreted the cupbearer's dream. He said, within 3 days, Pharaoh will restore you to your office. But he says, keep me in mind when it goes well with you and do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh so I can get out of this place. So I've done this thing for you, interpreted your dream, and it's a real positive outcome. You're going to be put back in this position of authority and respect and security in the face of Pharaoh. Of course, your buddy the baker, it's got a different story. He's going to be beheaded, and that's not going to go well for him. But don't forget me when you get out. So what happens? They forget him, of course. But here's the third part of the narrative here. 2 years later, so now it's been 2 years after he said, don't forget me, that Pharaoh had a dream, and he was standing by the Nile, and seven sleek and fat cows grazed in the marsh. Then seven other cows came up from the Nile. They were ugly and gaunt. Then the ugly and gaunt cows ate the seven sleek and fat cows. Pharaoh awoke from his dream, but no one could interpret it. Then the cupbearer spoke up, oh, wow, so a young Hebrew youth was with us when we were in jail a couple of years ago, and we had dreams. He was able to interpret them. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph. Pharaoh's dream is interpreted by Joseph. Pharaoh is amazed by Joseph's ability. And just like the jailer before him and Potiphar before him, Pharaoh makes Joseph the steward of his entire household. If you're the kind of guy who can interpret dreams like this and can tell us about the seven good years that are coming for us and the seven lean years that will follow, then you ought to be the kind of guy that is in charge of allocating the resources we've got. And so Joseph now is promoted to basically the chancellor of Egypt. And then famine strikes, not just Egypt, according to the dream, but also the whole area, including Canaan, where Joseph's family is from. And so we read, when the 7 years of plenty came to an end, the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. When the famine spread all over the face of the earth, the people came to Egypt to buy food from Joseph. And Jacob said to his sons, why are you staring at one another? I have heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go and buy for us so that we may live. And so Jacob sent all of his sons, all the brothers except for Benjamin, the little brother, the last son of Rachel. Joseph was ruler over the land, and he was the one who sold all the grain. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph, now think about that. The brothers come down from Canaan, and what do? They bow with their faces to the ground. Does that sound familiar? Oh, man, what about that dream? Based on the chronology of the text, about 13 years earlier, when Joseph had that dream and his brothers were so angry with him. But here it is. They bowed down before him. Joseph recognized his brothers, it says, but he disguised himself from them. By this time, Joseph is not just an older teenager, but he's a young man. He's 30 or perhaps slightly more. And in the Egyptian custom, his head has been shaved. He has no body hair. They do the whole, you know, mascara thing. And, you know, he just doesn't look recognizable to his brothers at all. He's speaking a different language. He's got an interpreter. So there's this weird dynamic going on. His brothers show up and they don't recognize Joseph for who he is. Joseph said to him, you're spies. Now he's going to yank on him a little bit. Why is he doing this? Because he's that nasty younger brother? Is he pigtail pulling? What's the deal? Well, I kind of think that way as a younger brother, but actually, no, that's not the way it is. That actually, he has a game plan in mind. His plan is not to just meet the temporary needs of his family, but to bring his entire family down into Egypt because he knows what that bigger picture is for them. And so he's going to create insecurity among them that's going to cause them to do the kind of actions that are ultimately going to be in their best interest. They replied, they said, "No, my Lord, we have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man from Canaan. The youngest brother is with him now, and one brother, Joseph, is dead." Then Joseph said, "You are all spies. Now I will test you. You must bring me your youngest brother. One of you must go get him, and the rest of you will stay here in prison." Well, 2 days later, Joseph changes his mind. He says, "Let one of you stay, one of the brothers stay in prison, and the rest of you can go back and bring your younger brother down to me." So they said to one another, "We are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul, yet when he pleaded with us, we would not listen. That is why this distress is coming upon us." Oh, it's like that telltale heart, you know, where their conscience is now just totally getting them. This Joseph is reminding them, how many brothers do you have? And you're going to bring the last one down, and forcing them to acknowledge that the one brother, in their view, is now dead. And it's just causing them to revisit their whole evil plot against Joseph to begin with. It really sets up the complete unworthiness of these brothers to receive anything from the hand of him who they victimized in such a terrible way. You see how that's working? Now let's read on. The brothers did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. And he turned away from them and he wept, because Joseph is just aware of the incredible tragedy of this situation. He's never lost his love for his family, even for his brothers. Then Joseph gave them provisions and he sent them on their journey. "Go home, get your little brother, get your dad. It's time for you all to come down here." Then later it says that the brothers returned to Egypt with Benjamin and they stood before Joseph, and Joseph could no longer control himself. "Have everyone go from me," he ordered. Then he wept so loudly that all could hear him. Imagine the wailing of this man as now all of his brothers, whom he thought he would never see again, have resurfaced. And now he is in that place where he can provide for them the very thing that they are going to need. Joseph says to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers, think of the drama here, his brothers couldn't answer him, for they were stunned. They were more than stunned. They're like, "Oh my God, what's going to happen next? We sold him into slavery. We completely dissed him and wrote him off. Now he's the most powerful man in the world, save Pharaoh himself." Oh, they just didn't know whether to use the facilities or make a phone call. It's just a moment of utter confusion came over them. Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer. I am your brother, Joseph." Wow. Just that physical move toward him would be so intimidating, given the guilt that saturated their every thought about their brother. "I am your brother," he doesn't mince words, "whom you sold to Egypt." And then one of the great but clauses of Genesis. But the narrative takes an unexpected turn. "Do not grieve or be angry with yourself because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. The famine has been in the land 2 years, and there are 5 years remaining. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of his household and ruler in Egypt. Now hurry and get my father. You shall live in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your flocks and all that you have. there I will provide for you. What an incredible story this is to reflect on here. And what I have is a picture of what's sometimes referred to as the Joseph insignia. And it is very likely one of the insignias that was used in the royal Egyptian court that has the name of Joseph on it, to stamp and to imprint into legal cuneiform clay tablet documents that authorize certain kinds of official state actions. It is very likely, we don't know this for sure, but it's very likely that this archaeological find in the area that the Old Testament calls Goshen is exactly from this period of time when Joseph himself was in charge of administrating all of the assets of Egypt, and where he then placed his family in this place called Goshen in the northeastern sector of Egypt, a place where pastures are prevalent and which keep them remote from the rest of the Egyptian population. And this is done because the Egyptians, were told in the narrative, loathe shepherds. They thought shepherding was a dirty profession, made them unclean in a spiritual way. And so they quadranted them off, which is exactly what God had in mind the whole time. God wanted his people to be safe and secure in Egypt as Canaan continued to experience all kinds of political and spiritual upheaval. And God was working with those people, but he took his own people out so that they might prosper more or less in a bit of a bubble, where they would be separated from all of the influences of the Egyptian people, and where they could grow in number in a significant way and truly become the people who would one day be able to inherit a land and rule it and experience the blessing of God in it. So there's something very important historically going on in this Joseph story. That's why it's the last story in the book of Genesis. It explains why the people are in Egypt and not in their promised land. It is because God was providing for them through Joseph and in this context to build them up as this unique people of God. But what a difficult reunion it was indeed, and the drama of the text cannot be overstated. These brothers who had had a whole history of alienation between them, all kinds of jealousies and treachery, all of this comes into focus as God is doing an amazing work to preserve his own people against their own efforts to thwart cooperation with him. Let's take a look at this. This is kind of the nub of the story right here. We've laid out the basic historical picture. Let's now talk about what God is doing. The first of three things we want to examine is the fact that there are things going on with Joseph that would be very difficult for any of us here to really process and maintain the same perspective, the same attitude that Joseph had. Think about that. How seriously dysfunctional this family really was. Some of us come from pretty dysfunctional families. This is a bad one when you want to kill your brother and then decide instead to have mercy on him by selling him as a slave. He's hated, hated, and more hated. The narrative makes it really clear. And so you've got this really unstable thing with Joseph and his brothers. You have the false accusation that Joseph has to live under by Potiphar's wife. This Hebrew slave whom you bought and brought to us has come to make sport of me. That's a lie. Man, I just hate it when people say things that aren't true about me. I don't know about you. Maybe you like that. I doubt it. Nobody likes to have talk smack about you when the smack's not the way it really is. We feel like we have a right to our reputation and the truth matters. But yet, in this case, he goes from being hated by his brothers to being falsely accused by this woman, even though he's trying to maintain his own integrity. And then finally, he's forgotten in jail. Can you imagine being in an Egyptian jail for 2 years? having been basically totally forgotten? And what are you thinking as each etching in your cell, you know, day one, day two, now you've filled an entire wall with slash marks. And it's just like, you know, this is totally not fair. I don't deserve a minute of this. And oh yeah, here's a good question. Where's God in all of this? I thought there was supposed to be this thing where my family is like bowing down before me. That sure doesn't look like it in here. How far he must have felt from this exalted place that these dreams had cast him in. And he had to wonder, what is up with this? And like some of us, maybe as well, we wonder, God has made us promises of life and abundant life, and that he has the power and the will to enable us to overcome deep things in our life, to experience real change in this world. And yet we just feel like in a certain way how far we are from realizing the elevated language of what it means to be a child of God and his great love for us, because we're languishing in a jail perhaps of our own creation. And that's where Joseph was. And so there is an important thing here, because there's nothing in the text that would suggest that Joseph caved to the counsel of his fears or held resentment when I think even the best of us would be inclined in that direction. And so there's something about that. We wonder, what was it about Joseph that enabled him to keep perspective even in the face of all of these things? And that brings us really to our next point, and the crucial point from the vertical perspective on this text, which is the sovereignty of God. This narrative is really about God's sovereignty, that the last scene is simply a completion of the first scene being the dream that he had, that all of his family would bow down before him, and in the end scene where they actually do that, not to exalt Joseph, but to receive from God the provision that he had for his entire family. God is sovereign. It says four times in chapter 39 that the Lord was with Joseph in those really difficult times where he's wondering, you know, how is it that this dream could possibly be fulfilled? Yet it says, God, the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. Reminds me of the poignant words of Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, where it says, I will never leave you, and I will never forsake you. Do you believe that about the Lord God? No matter where you are here tonight, the circumstances that you may be facing, the difficulties that you are trying to sort through. You know, maybe you have really painted yourself into a corner, you made some decisions along the way, and now it's time to pay the piper. And you're broken in important ways in your life. You feel alone. When we are laboring under the burden of failure, we feel alone. That's the most prominent kind of emotion that comes. Because why? Because sin separates us. It alienates us. And so we may be feeling here tonight alone in our marriages, alone as we try to be the parents that we know that we need to be and that God has called us to be. Alone when we talk about, when we think about people in our lives that God has placed there in his sovereignty for us to care for, but we feel that we don't have what it takes to move towards them in an effective way. We may feel that sense of our past having caught up with us. We feel alone. But we're not alone. I will never leave you, nor will I ever forsake you. That is a promise of God. So things may be the equivalent of feeling that, like Joseph, you're in jail and the promise of God is just a distant abstraction. But now we're in that place where it's like, do I believe in what God has said? Am I prepared to entrust myself to His Word even against the weight of my own feeling states? And that becomes a very important point of decision. That the entire trajectory of our life, and so I don't want to say this glibly, I want you to understand what I'm saying. The entire trajectory of our life may hang in the balance of whether we cave to the counsel of our fears and the weight of our emotional life, or we take a stand with the things that God has promised and say, I believe that. That's what I will trust in. That's what I will act upon. And so I don't know whether it will be this month, this year, or whenever it will be, but God will liberate me from this jail. And that is a place that we've got to find ourselves in. Or we will collapse into despair and cynicism and unbelief. And really, it's a very binary situation that Christians are in. We believe in the promises of God and trust that He is with us, or we just collapse into under the weight of the things that are in our life. There just is no other way. He says, both in chapter 45 and in 50, it was God who sent me before you to preserve life. You know, if he didn't have that understanding, it was God who was involved here. Oh yeah, you freely chose. You did what you were going to do out of spite and hate and anger and jealousy and all of these things. But you know what? I understand that there's a bigger picture here. Then there is the picture that God is involved, and that it was really at the end of the day in the plan of God that I come here, even if by this totally dishonest way that you delivered me. So therefore, he can say, it was God who sent me here to preserve life. It was not you who sent me here, but God. Wow, that's a very striking and powerful thing to say. Then in chapter 50, he says, again, you meant it for evil against me. He's not absolving them of their guilt or their responsibility. He's not saying, hey, that's okay. The story ended up okay, so just forget about it. No, he's keeping them aware of the faults that they have so that they can understand in a more poignant way the generosity of God through the undeserving. Okay, that's grace. But he makes it equally clear that God meant whatever your decision-making was for good, and namely for your good. And so we are left with this picture that God works even through sinful human choices. That really, as it ends up, is really the center of the biblical story, in fact. That God has granted to human beings the freedom to pursue, well, whatever it is we want to pursue. And He does not withhold from us the consequences of that pursuit. And that's why we are as individuals, just as we are as a humanity, very broken. Because we can choose to defy God, but we do it at our own peril. Because God created us to draw our life from Him, to yield to His good will and purpose for our life. And so while He has dignified us with the ability to choose and even to defy Him, He has not shielded us from the reality of what would happen if we did in fact defy Him. And the Bible declares that all have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. All of us are guilty. Each of us, Isaiah tells us in Isaiah chapter 53, like sheep have gone astray. Each has gone his own way, which is not God's way. You know, in April of 33 AD, something very provocative and amazing happened, and which is that humanity, represented both by the Roman government and the Jewish religious establishment, rose up with one mind to put one man to death. In their paranoid hatred of Jesus of Nazareth, they decide the best thing that we can do to get rid of this embarrassing teacher, this threat to our little cardboard kingdom, is to string this guy up. And so they did. But you know what? That's not the end of the story, because when we consider the cross of Christ, we see it on the one hand, like Joseph's brothers, as an act of total defiance of evil, of raising the fist of defiance and more to the Lord God. You know, if God is one of us, what do? We string him up. And we're free to do that. But God is at work. And even though we defy him, through our very defiance, he turns to blessing. Because it is in the death of Christ that he takes upon himself the burden of all of our guilt, all of our failing, so that he can turn and extend to us completely unmerited favor, so that he can extend to us forgiveness for our wrongdoing, because our guilt has been paid in full to telestai. That, my friends, is the picture of the Bible from beginning to end. God acts in a context where he gives freedom to his creatures to do what they will. We are not automatons that are forced to do as God directs. We are free agents who choose to do whatever is within our hearts and in our capacities to do. And even in our defiance against him, he turns to blessing. He uses our very defiance as the opportunity to give. Wow, that is the God with whom we have to do. And this picture of Joseph that we have, in some ways, just fits into this broader stamp of the image of God in history. God promises, man can never deliver, so he blesses. So he makes the infertile fertile. So he takes even our rebellion against him as an opportunity to extend blessing. There's an opportunity for us here tonight to really think about this in a personal way. And that is that maybe you here tonight are able to identify, and maybe, though we might not admit it to anyone else, to God at least, we know, I am like the brothers of Joseph. There's plenty on my plate that render me undeserving and distant from God. And here's an opportunity to understand the God of the Bible. He is the God who says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And when we look at the cross of Christ, yes, it is a picture of our guilt. But at the same time, it is this opportunity to say to God, now I get it. Now I understand. The idea of grace is that you come to me and give me what I don't deserve, and just that I can receive by asking. The miracle of reconciliation with you and of forgiveness. That's the God that we're dealing with here. And we get this early picture in Genesis of what that's really about. Now, let's move on here quickly. It's clear from the narrative as well that God has a purpose. He says, God sent me before you to preserve life. That's right. And God has a purpose for your life too, regardless of your failures, regardless of what you've been dealt. No one's been dealt out. And I think it's really important for us to take stock. And some of us, at the age that we're at today, you know, kind of look at the past and say, I wish I'd done things differently. however many years ago, but here I am, and here it is. Right? Anyone besides me ever raise that question in their mind? Sorry, I'll just talk about myself then. And, you know, the things that we have done in our rebellion against God, the failures that we've had, yeah, they do disqualify us in a certain way. There's a different pathway for our life than would have been without those things. That's a fact. There's a real loss. But there's also real opportunity because God is big. God is good. God is sovereign. And God has a purpose for our lives and the full knowledge of the kind of choices that we would make. And I think it's a really beautiful thing to say at this stage of our life, no matter what stage that is for you, and in this room there is a variation from of 50 and more years, just to be able to say, you know, God, I do believe, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10, that I am your masterpiece, created in Christ Jesus for works of excellence that you prepared before I ever was. Knowing the full truth about this person that is going to come into the world, you've created works of excellence to perform. And this is what I'm just calling us to like Joseph, who recognizes that God has singled him out for a particular purpose, that God has selected each of us for a unique purpose as well. And to have that confidence and to seek him out. He's with us, so why don't we put ourselves before him and say, Lord, what is that thing? What is that purpose that you're calling me to in my life? And it is as we orient our lives around an increasingly clear picture of God's purpose for us that the pieces come together, that life begins to make sense. And then the best of who God has made us begin to float to the surface. It's an incredible thing to see this in the lives of people at every stage. Paul just puts it so plainly. He says, God causes all things to work together for the good to those who love him and to those who are called according to his purpose. And so the question for us is, do we believe that that's true? There's a decision that we really need to come to. And again, this is something that's going to really have that super defining effect on our life. Are we going to look to the things, like Joseph must have at various points in his life, the betrayal by his brothers, their hatred for him, the betrayal of Potiphar's wife, the 2 years he spends in prison unjustly, having been forgotten, all of these things? Are we going to be ruled by the real pain and damage in our life, or are we going to be transformed through them? We may not be responsible for a lot of the suffering that we experience, just like Joseph was. In my case, I can't say that. That's the plain truth. About 99.9% of the suffering I've done has been totally self-inflicted. But nonetheless, we can either stand there with the difficulties that we face, with the damage of our heart, of our soul, of our character, of our value system, of our bodies. And we can either allow those things to define us and to be ruled by them, and the fears and the anger, the frustrations, the anxieties that come with that, or we can allow the difficult things that we face in our lives to be moments of real transformation. I'm reminded of the analogy that C.S. Lewis uses in the book, The Problem of Pain. He makes this point. He says, you know, the physical pain is there for a reason. It is an alarm that there's something wrong with our body. Imagine not being able to have the gift of pain. You would never know that you needed help to deal with problems that your body is having, right? Leprosy, that's the word in the antihistamine stupor here. You know why lepers have all these broken fingers and everything? It's not because leprosy breaks your joints. It's because they don't feel any pain. They grab a doorknob and not know how tightly to grasp it. And so they grasp it so tightly that it actually breaks their fingers. Things like that. Pain is a gift. It is a call to us that something is wrong. And that pain is not just a physical thing, but also the deep emotional pains of our life. We want to medicate those things. We want to get by them as quickly as possible. But what the Bible calls us to is to be aware of the signal that pain is, deep pain in our soul, because it signals the fact that something is broken, something's wrong, and God is trying to get your attention through the pain that you're experiencing. And so, my friends, you will be ruled either by the desire to make the pain go away and therefore not experience the kind of real change that God is offering to you in Christ. Or you'll hear that voice and you'll say to God, show me the hurtful way within, as the psalmist describes. And that will be the thing that more or less determines the trajectory of your life. So I plead with you that God in His sovereignty is at work in your life just as He was through Joseph's life. And the things that occur in you are not accidental in the sense that God is unaware of these things and they are beyond His capacity to use as key moments of transformation in your life, no matter how low things may be. God has allowed that because He wants to get your attention, because He has something better. He wants to bless your life. And so the book of Genesis comes to a conclusion with this incredible thing of this completely degenerate family with very little, frankly, virtue attached to them, other than the fact that they are beloved of God, who have migrated now to this place in Egypt where they are sectioned off from everyone else, and where for hundreds of years they will be able to grow and thrive and set the foundation for the next epic moment of biblical history, which is the exodus from Egypt and the return to the promised land. And with that, I guess we're done with our study of Genesis.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.